Hello, and welcome to Relentless Pursuit with the Shantz Mantione Group. I'm Andrew Shantz. I'm proud to be here with my partner, Jill Faherty Lloyd, as we bring you the latest installment of our podcast. Today, we're excited to have a chat with Matthew Newton, UBS Art Advisory Specialist, or as we like to say, the art guy. And we're going to have a conversation about what's happening in the art world, what our clients are doing, how we interface, and kind of all things art. So, Matt, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Yeah, my pleasure. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Fun to have you.
So, you have a really cool job, I think at least. Maybe you could start off by telling us how you got here, what your path is, and your passions.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. My boss likes to remind me that I have a really great job here. Yeah, which is always nice. But it's true. We have a really fascinating opportunity to work with some of the great collecting clients of the firm, which is exciting. My background is not in financial services, so I came out of the art world. I spent about a decade in the commercial gallery space here in New York, and so had a great lens through that experience to see what collectors really, how they think about building their collections over the long term. How they're making decisions, not just for following a specific trend or a specific moment in history in a 3-month or 6-month or even 12-month cycle, but really thinking about how they're building something of significance over decades, you know. And that's a type of lens that I like to bring to our clients here in that type of conversation. And that really, you know, means focusing on quality. I think, you know, when you're looking at artworks, you know, really thinking about why does this matter in the greater history of the art world? And why would that matter into the future as well? And I think that's something that without that level of sort of historical knowledge and presence in the art world and paying attention to that, just like it, as you would research really any other type of investment, really knowing what the broader kind of landscape is. So even though I work for a bank now, I really spend a lot of my time still in the art world. You know, last night, after client meetings here during the day, I went to sort of see gallery openings in the evening and meet with gallerists and spend time doing those things. And I'll do that again tonight. So that's really a big part of my role as well, as staying connected with all of the relevant parties in the art world, from artists, gallerists, curators, museum professionals, all of those sorts of things, and bringing those resources sort of back as a nexus to our clients.
So as a bit of an aspiring art geek, I think that is a really cool job, quite frankly. It sounds awesome. And so, you know, with your background and your current role, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit about what's happening in the art world. You know, we're a few months after Art Basel Miami Beach, which I was fortunate enough to attend. And I know you've just returned from Freeze LA, which is sort of, I guess, would say growing big West Coast art presence. Can you give us sort of a top line view of the market today and what you're seeing in that space?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. Dialing back to December in Miami, I think there was, or really maybe if we kind of even step a little further back and give kind of the overall picture of what has happened over the last few years in the art market. I like to start off by saying that it's important to keep in mind, as is the case with any market, there is like an overall art market, and there are certain kind of like macro trends that apply there. And we can speak to some of those things, but it's also maybe a little more so than other markets, particular in the way that it is made up of these micro markets around, you know, individual artists, even individual periods within those artists' work. And so while it is possible to follow kind of like overall trends and strength in a market, that does affect when collectors choose to buy and sell things. It's also, it really gets down to a nuanced point because collections are so individual and specific. And so just as a case in point in that, if you are looking, a collector who's looking for a specific work by a specific artist from the 1950s or whatever it might be, if you've been waiting for that moment to buy something for 5 or 10 years and you finally get the chance to do it, whatever is happening in the market is, you probably don't care, right? Like you're going to make that purchase.
Sure.
And you might even stretch. Even in a down market, you might stretch. Or even if it's a booming market, you get a deal, you're going to take that, obviously. So I think that's one thing that's important to keep in mind. But thinking back to the state of affairs now, coming out of the sort of post-pandemic time, we saw, as we did in many other kinds of assets, just an absolute speculative boom in the art market. And so people seem to be willing to pay just about any price to acquire a wide range of art objects, things that probably didn't deserve those prices, you know, in some cases. And so we really saw the valuations of art shoot up. We saw sort of record overall sales at auction houses for the years. Sort of in the late, you know, 2021, moving into 2022. And then we really saw a kind of a downdraft, you know, in the market following that, the sort of sobering up of the market, so to speak, after that speculative boom. And in that period, I think one thing that's interesting to note, a lot of people describe the art market as being very detached and distinct from other financial markets. That is true in some cases, but you can actually also see a real pattern where those tend to match. And so most collectors tend to be asset holders of other types as well, right? You
know,
they have all kinds of assets. And so when you see, you know, even public equity markets sort of trend downward, the art market tends to sort of slow down as well, because those same asset holders are really thinking about the broader picture of their wealth picture. So we saw that as the stock market kind of leveled off in the last year and a half or so before. And then, of course, you know, in the last 6 or 9 months, as the market has really, you know, picked up, the art market has also kind of gone with it in many ways. And we've really seen that in action. We have seen basically no recession in the art market, right? It's been very strong. When we were in Miami, sales seemed robust. Galleries were doing a lot of business. Collectors were eager to buy. That seemed to be very much the case in Miami in December. I saw that again in Los Angeles just last week for the Freeze LA Art Fair. I think there was a lot of transactions happening, a lot of appetite to buy. And I think that so far there's really no sign that is changing in any really, you know, significant way. So I'm excited for the art market. We also have the UBS Art Basel Art Market Report. Its next iteration is being released shortly within the next couple of weeks. So we're going to have a snapshot of the entire sort of global art market from 2023, authored by this UBS Art Basel report. So I think that'll be, hopefully will back up what I'm saying here from an anecdotal standpoint. Yeah, but in my view, I think it's been a very strong market this last 6 to 9 months.
Ooh, thank you, Matthew, for the sneak peek of that.
Yes.
If I could just segue a little bit, UBS has the largest corporate art collection in the world, and you can talk about how many pieces. And it's been curated by Mary Rizal for the last, I don't know, 8 years or so. She's really transformed the collection. Can you talk a little bit about the trends that you're seeing in the market? And how it might be reflected in the UBS collection?
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. So you're right. Our colleague Mary Rozell and her team of 10 curators globally have done a terrific job navigating the corporate collection over that time period. The collection stands at over 30,000 pieces globally. Most of that work is installed throughout the UBS offices around the world. Some of it is on public display. Even we have here at the 1285 Avenue of the Americas in New York, we have a public-facing gallery, which currently has an exhibition of Lucian Freud works, over 50 of those that are part of the UBS collection.
It's wonderful.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah, if anybody's in the neighborhood, it's really worth stopping by and walking through.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Jill and I spent a little time with it yesterday, which is really pleasant. And, you know, what I think is interesting about the transition of the UBS collection, which was really, I would describe in the past as a sort of visionary collection of a CEO leader who did an incredible job in many ways of building a collection. And then in the years since with, you know, head of the curation of that collection by Mary, there's been really an effort to represent a more global and diverse community of voices in the collection. And I think they've done a very successful job of that. And so you have really a group of works that are bringing in the voices of women artists, of artists of color, of artists from different regions of the world that really, you know, wasn't sort of fully represented in the collection in the past. And so I know that's something that they're very proud of, and I think they've done a great job of that. One thing that I think is interesting to note about it is this collection is one example of that happening in a much broader sense, right? So not only is it corporate collections that are making those kinds of decisions, but you see museums telling a much broader story. This has been going on now for 10, 15, 20 years of a real sort of adaptation of the market to a broader story of the history of art from the last 100 years or so, 50 to 100 years. And so museums have started telling that story. So you have a gallery that now has new names for people that are showing up, you know, in the museum. I was at the SF MoMA, for example, a couple of weeks ago, and in addition to the Pollocks and the Krasners and things like that, or just, you have artists like, I should say, Lee Krasner, who's now becoming actually almost a common name. Yeah. In a sense, you have artists like Norman Lewis being shown, who would not have been part of that story in a really sort of broad-based way in the past. And you also see that story being told with individual collectors, right? So collectors care about having a diverse range of voices represented in what's hanging on their walls. You know?
Well, I noticed the last couple of years at Art Basel, the overwhelming amount of art by women, which is exciting for me to see. And there was actually a really good article that you were quoted in Barron's on sort of this phenomenon of the woman collector and the importance of building out a robust collection and making history. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Happy to. Yes, you're right. There's a great article by author Abby Schultz in the Barron's Penta last November, which was following the major auctions that had just happened in New York that month. And she picked up on this sort of, I hesitate to use the word trend, but we'll say that for now, of market acknowledgement for female artists, right? And one of the really sort of key moments that we saw in November that really kind of crystallized that was works by the artist Joan Mitchell. There were two different artworks from either side of her career, one from the 1950s, one from the 1990s, and each sold, sort of both shattered her previous record and sold for nearly $30 million each. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is a really significant statement by the market of an acknowledgement and acceptance of the prominence and leadership, frankly, of an artist, you know, like that. And so that's, you're seeing that with historical artists. You're starting to see it also with sort of new and emerging artists as well, women artists. And so you have really the market giving a lot of promise. So estimates, the prices achieved at auction shooting way past their estimates for relatively young, sort of newly established artists that really helped to tell that story for this next generation. One of the, I think the key things to note as a counterpoint is that there's still the amount of art that's sold in total in galleries and auction houses that were made by women is still much, much less than the amount of art that's sold made by men. And I think there's still a much longer time of historical correction that has to happen with that. In the past, really up until that last 40 or 50 years, men were primarily the ones given the time and space to focus on their artwork, right? And women were sort of expected to do a supporting role. That has changed since then, but that's going to take time to correct sort of from a market standpoint. And so I'm really excited to see sort of what the future holds in that, because I don't think we're going backwards in that way.
That's an interesting point, just to circle back. And I don't know exactly the numbers from any of these big art fairs, but it's massive amounts of money that is changing hands. And, you know, we do work for a wealth management firm, so the money side of it is interesting to me. So sounds like there's an, when you're talking about these underrepresented artists, whether it's women or artists of color or from different areas of the world, are we at a point, obviously, if you're talking about paintings that were done in the 1950s, that artist may no longer be with us. So are we seeing a point where the artists themselves are actually getting some of the revenue from these things, or are these coming out of old collections and, you know, putting more money into the coffers of people that could buy really expensive art anyway?
That's a great question. I would say that for historical artists, those works will obviously, in most cases, be more expensive. And so a, you know, nearly $30 million painting is normally going to be in by a, you know, have achieved in the sort of the fairly distant past from several decades ago. being an artist is definitely not an easy job or an easy life. Most artists, you know, have to find ways to navigate their financial lives, you know, in a limited way, and don't see that type of success that you would sort of assume comes with a $30 million price tag. Artists like Joan Mitchell, for example, you know, that group of artists, I mean, they really struggled, you know, early in their lives. You know, many of them lived really hand to mouth at that time. I would say the landscape is a little different today, for sure. There's much more of an industry around the art market. You do see, and that's, I think, a sort of heavily acknowledged commentary on the art market generally. You really have a much more professionalized circumstance where artists, you know, go to grad school and get degrees, get gallery representation, and can start earning a real living. That said, the number of artists who are able to do that today is still percentage-wise very small compared to the amount of artists who are also, you know, working. It's just a much bigger art world in general. But it is a more professionalized type of career, so to speak. So you do see artists getting to see the benefits of their labor more today than I think you did in the past.
As the art market evolves, which it continues to do, how does technology start to play into this? I'm really curious to see about AI and, you know, other developments, fractional ownership. Can you talk a little bit about a few of those trends?
Sure. Happy to. One that we heard the most about following that post-pandemic time were NFTs. And I think that is going to be, there's a couple of ways to look at that. With NFTs, I don't think the interesting part of that has anything to do really with art itself. You know, if you think about it, we've had digital art for a long time. We've been making some form of digital art for many decades now. It can be interesting as a system or of ownership, basically. So being able to tell the provenance of a piece. I think there's the potential we could see that technology helping us to a degree tell the story of ownership of an artwork. And I think that for people who have grown up digitally native, the idea of, you know, like for me, a painting from my history, that's real art. But if you've grown up digitally native, seeing something on the screen is just as easily, you can call that real art. And being able to prove that you own that is, you know, the function of the NFT services. And I think that there are a lot of people that sort of value that as a framework of ownership. And I think that'll probably continue to happen, but I think it's not tremendously interesting overall in the art world. I think we've seen that from the market standpoint too. So we had this dramatic increase in prices and interest in transactions with anything that was called an NFT. And that's basically returned to where it was prior to that speculative fervor. It's almost zero. You know, a lot of galleries set up these special NFT marketplaces. They're almost all gone now.
So round-tripped.
Mostly round-tripped. Yeah. Now, that said, there is a totally separate ecosystem for that among a different type of artist that's really be considered outside of the quote-unquote art world, right? And a lot of those collectors still value that. So I think there are embers of an interest, you know, in that regard.
I would just add something on the NFTs. It really caught my attention. I have three teenagers, and when that fervor was going on, they were talking about friends that were buying NFTs and the expectation that they would buy something for $10 and this is going to be worth millions. And it was striking to watch, a frenzy of something that would be normally, I think, so foreign to a bunch of teenagers, although we've dragged our teenagers through all museums all over the country and the world as much as we can. But I think for most of them, it was such a foreign thing. But that speculative fervor was so intense and so pervasive for a little while there.
And it really wasn't just for that technology. That's a great point. It really took over a large part of the art market, where this idea of like, oh, I buy it for this price and I'll get to sell it for this much greater price later.
Right. Right.
And I think that, obviously, that's a sign that things are a little bit off kilter. You know, the art world.
In any market,
exactly.
But I think what we're hearing is this idea of affordability in art, right? So if we think about a Jackson Pollock, not affordable. It's in museums, but we've got, you know, underrepresented artists at more affordable prices. this idea of NFTs. And then there's also this notion of fractional ownership, which I'd love you to touch on.
Mm, sure.
And then we'll land on AI because I'm really interested
yeah,
in
sure.
that. I don't want this to end without that.
Yeah, no problem. With the fractionalized space, I think is also another interesting technological development where in the past several years, certain companies have started buying works, converting them basically into listed securities and selling fractionalized shares in those artworks to the public primarily. And I think it's definitely an interesting technological development. I do have a lot of, I guess, kind of questions and doubts about how successful it will be in the long term for those shares. And mostly it's based on kind of the expectations of going into it. Any collector who has been, buying art for a long period of time will understand and acknowledge that if the collection has been successful in a financial sense, where, works, they spent X amount on the collection and today it's worth much greater amount, that's happened in a relatively small number of artworks in that collection. It tends to be around 10 to 15% of the artworks in the collection that will show the overall kind of financial performance, again, to speak about it in those terms, of the collection.
That's interesting.
That's fairly common.
And so you really have to like the art that you buy.
You have to, number one, like the art that you buy, and you have to have a lot of art. And that's really the successful collections, right? And again, in this financial term, where you have just a few of the artworks that do well. And so if you concentrate, if you're buying shares just in one artwork or a small handful of artworks, then comparing that to the overall return, so to speak, of the art market, which is very hard to define in the first place, is really, really hard to do. So I just really would like to temper expectations that investors approach with that. The art market is a place with a lot of distinctions from other markets. It's highly illiquid. It's highly specific. You have an artwork by the same artist from the same year might be a different value than one. It's the exact same artist, the exact same year, but it's just, it could be a Tuesday instead of a Wednesday and the price is different for really, it's hard to know why. And I think that those kinds of realities can be overlooked when you're thinking about the fractionalized art market. If you try to think of art just as a share, as a financial instrument, it really sort of creates a really blanket over a lot of those nuances to the art market that I think are important to keep in mind.
It's really interesting. Great perspective.
And so covering the AI portion, I think that that's where I really think things will be. It's the most kind of interesting technological development over the last several years as it relates to art and art making. Not necessarily because interesting art will be made with AI technology, but how the technology will impact how artists think about what they're doing. And when I speak about this, I often cite the development of photography in the mid-19th century. And so you had, artists were, at that point, the ones who were, they had the job of creating representations of what was around us, right? And so they would make portraits of people, and they would paint landscapes and pictures of buildings and that sort of thing. And when photography came along, there was really, it was kind of like the end of painting. Like we didn't really need to do those things anymore, right? Artists didn't need to do that. And so everyone thought like, well, I guess that's going to be the end of painting because we have photography now. But what happened instead is actually painting became much more valuable, much more sought after, but it pushed it in an unexpected and totally different direction. And so after several decades of photography being around, we saw abstract painting start to develop, for example. And I think that something like that will probably happen now with the presence of AI and generative art. So if you can produce any image that you want at the push of a button, then what does it mean to create something that's actually rare and interesting? And I think that for collectors, part of what they want to do is have something that's unique and rare and special. That's part of the reason to own it in the first place. And so I see them looking for works that will fit that description, in the future. And that might mean that things that are handmade and personal and human-based are actually become, more valuable from that standpoint. That's a possibility. But it's a big kind of unknown.
I love the musings of Matthew Newton.
I know, yeah.
That's just a great comparison. Yeah. That's really interesting to think about how photography impacted and what this might do. We're very fortunate to have you here at UBS, and I know, you know, obviously you were with Jill and some clients last night, and you know, the real question is, how are our clients working with you? Like, what's the best way that you can work with clients and help them? And maybe if you've got a good story or two to say, you know, some impact that we've been able to bring to their collection, that would be great.
Sure. Happy to speak to that. We really, through the Art Advisory Service at UBS, I think that one thing that's special about it is that it's really included in the relationship that we have with our sort of top tier clients, you know, at the firm. And so because of that, this role is able to have a level of independence that you don't find very often, number one in the art world, and number two at other firms, frankly. You know, so we're able to really interact with our clients in a very honest and transparent way to give advice, really pure advice about how they engage with the art market. You know, I often point out, which if it's not completely obvious, that the art market is a very opaque and completely unregulated place. And so a lot of people are attracted to the idea of building collections, and it's a really exciting thing to do, but it's something that you really have to go into with like eyes wide open, you know, about the decisions that you're making, and the responsibility rests with the individual to do it properly. And so I feel fortunate that this role, we really get to give that type of advice to clients to sort of be a flashlight a bit into kind of a darkened space, you know, in the art market. In that way, we really partner with clients across I describe it as the life cycle of collecting. So from, you know, those beginning stages, developing a collection, you know, how to work with galleries, auction houses, the questions to ask when you're considering buying a work of art, even identifying what it is that you're interested in collecting in the first place, creating that strategy around your collection, you know, where could this possibly go, how to begin setting a budget for a collection, you know, how to allocate a certain amount of resources to certain works. So we work on all of those questions with our clients, and we've had a number of successful stories around that. I'd say one of our more typical clients are successful entrepreneurs who have sold a business or a portion of their business, and they're now, you know, they've been working, you know, 70 hours a week for 30 years, you know, building this business, and now they have the time and the resources to begin thinking about developing a collection, and they and their family, you know, are sort of looking for guidance on how to do that. So we work with them. We have a number of great interactions around that. The sort of next portion of the life cycle is that caring for the collection. So you're building this wonderful collection. It has real value. How do you properly take care of it? So what are the resources you need in terms of insurance, shipping and storage, conservation, art attorneys if you're considering a certain kind of transaction, all of those kinds of resources we connect our clients with. We often find, I would say, a typical client for that type of interaction is a family office executive. So let's say you have a family leader who's building a collection, and they've charged their family office executive with taking care of it. And that person might come from the financial industry, is not really sort of educated or had experience in the art world. And so we help those individuals with sort of the basic sort of the toolbox they need basically to complete that work.
So opening doors for them.
Exactly. Yep. That's exactly right. And introducing them to those resources that they need. And then the third component is really that legacy planning. So what's going to happen to this collection over the long term? If you've been successful in building a collection, in theory, it will outlive you by design. That's sort of the nature of what we're doing. So great collectors become temporary custodians of these collections, these great artworks. And so that conversation will naturally come about of, you know, are the children interested in this collection? Are there institutions that we value and we want to support with the collection? How do we think smartly about the strategic trust and estate decisions that we're making around the collection? So all of that type of conversation, I think that's a special time where this role can partner with our advanced planning attorneys and our philanthropy team to really create a holistic plan for those families. And so we've had a number of great interactions on that front too.
He's a heck of a resource.
He absolutely is. This has been phenomenal chatting. I know you're going straight from here to a client meeting. So just want to say we really appreciate your time and the thoughtful conversation. It's been a lot of fun. for us, I know, and we look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Matthew.
Thanks, Matthew. If anyone listening has questions about how Matthew can help them or talking even about the UBS art collection, please reach out to us at theshantmantiongroup.com or find us on our website. And thanks to all of our listeners. Make sure you smash the subscribe button on the Shantz Mantione Relentless Pursuit podcast so you can get all of our latest content. Thanks again.